how do we change the mindset day to day at the working level? That's where I think it's still a challenge, and I think it's still, we're ways off.
All right, we're back with episode number 118 of Future Proof. Bill Sheridan's my name. How you doing, by the way? Everything good? Staying healthy? We had a bit of a scare here recently, here being our home in St. Louis. Spent the last couple of weeks in quarantine. My daughter's boyfriend came down with the dreaded COVID. So my wife and my daughter and I spent 2 solid weeks locked up in the house. Got to know each other really, really well. All's good though. Everything's fine. Everyone is fine. None of us got sick. No symptoms at all. And we are thankful for that. And my daughter's boyfriend, he recovered pretty quickly. So back to normal at Shea Sheridan. Just a reminder, I guess, of who's in charge, right? And it ain't us. Right now, it's this stupid virus. So stay healthy, my friends. Keep doing the right things. Wear your mask, right? Stay physically distant. Avoid crowds. All of that. Do your part. Keep everyone healthy. Got it? All right. Listen, this week's show is sponsored, as always, by the Business Learning Institute, which delivers competency-based curriculum, courses, content, and community to maximize career trajectories and grow intellectual capital for organizational and executive leadership. Hundreds of courses, dozens of instructors, unlimited customization. What that means? No limits. Find out how the Business Learning Institute can help you by visiting blionline.org. So, this week's show, we've got a diversity and inclusion flavored conversation for you. We're going to talk about this stuff on a semi-regular basis here because, it's important. These types of conversations are one of the keys to moving the needle on diversity and inclusion in this profession. And God knows we need that, right? If we want to future-proof our careers, our organizations, our profession, it's got to include heavy doses of diversity, equality, and inclusion. So we're going to be intentional about seeking out these types of conversations. And this week, I'm sitting down with Anoop Mehta. Anoop is president of Science Systems and Applications in Lanham, Maryland. That's just outside of DC. It's a leading provider of scientific research and development and engineering and information analytics services in the earth and space science disciplines. Pretty cool stuff. He's also a former chair of the Maryland Association of CPAs Board of Directors, a current member of the Board of Directors of the American Institute of Certified Professional Accountants. He's also a council member of the Chartered Institute of Management Accountants. He's also an immigrant, an Indian American, and just around an all-around great guy. Anoop is truly just one of the nicest folks you'll ever meet. And he has a unique take on this country and this profession and this conversation, you know, and what the future holds. We'll get to that conversation here in just a moment. First, here's what caught my eye this week. It's an article from Harvard Business Review titled "How Businesses Can Recruit and Develop More Young People of Color." And in it, the authors, Joyzel Cunningham and Angela Jackson, they take a look at the dedicated efforts that some organizations are making to build a more diverse and equal and inclusive workplace. So here's an excerpt from that article. It's a little bit lengthy, but bear with me. They write, quote, "As we engage in conversations about recovery and reopening during the pandemic, many higher education institutions and employers are being forced to rethink long-standing practices that have resulted in COVID-19 having a disproportionate impact on youth of color. Many of these practices are entrenched in historical, economic, and environmental inequities born out of systemic racism. Now is the time for us to build equitable systems that meet the needs of all young people. So how can employers start? Number one, start professional development early. More must be done to reach students earlier in their academic careers to help them tap into job exploration, skills building, and professional development. One of the most effective and proactive steps employers can take is to expand quality internships for young people of color. No online training module or YouTube video can replace the learning that takes place when a young person interacts with professionals in their industry of interest. Number two, increase access to technology. Employers must take into account that many young people of color who need these types of remote professional development programs do not have access to them due to the digital divide. The good news is that businesses can work to create change here. One option that has proved effective is partnering and supporting organizations already doing this hard work with success. Reapply, for example, is a climate tech company that combines a resource sharing network with a user-friendly asset management platform that allows corporations to donate laptops to students and communities in need. In another effort, Capor Capital's SMASH, now that's a program that provides students of color with intensive STEM education, culturally relevant coursework, and access to resources and social capital, recently announced support for an initiative to donate 5,000 computers and internet access to college-age students who have been impacted by COVID-19 and are learning to code. Both these organizations can serve as examples for businesses looking to make a positive impact. Similar partnerships can be made at the hiring level. Several organizations are already working with employers to create more equitable opportunities for recent grads of color. Braven, for example, works with businesses and universities alike to launch students into strong first jobs, empowering young people to lead within companies and organizations they join following graduation. And number three, improving hiring practices. When it comes to actual hiring practices, separate efforts must be put into place to ensure that graduates of color can thrive in a post-COVID world. Human resource departments and hiring managers need to challenge the notion that talent comes only from certain institutions or that particular achievements serve as a proxy for success. Research has shown that diverse teams result in greater innovation and therefore we can assume better financial performance. For businesses to put this finding into practice, they cannot continue to hire based on the myth that only those who attend elite institutions during their formative years are eligible for entry-level positions. Instead, they must expand where they look for talent, which should be everywhere. To begin, companies should screen resumes without names and schools and use clear rubrics. Organizations like Deloitte and HSBC and the BBC have begun using this method of blind recruitment, removing name, age, education, and other indicators that might unintentionally introduce bias into the hiring process. The goal should be for organizations to align their hiring rubrics, screening questions, and tests with the skills needed in a specific position rather than using degrees from elite institutions or references from people they know as proxies. And then the article ends with this, quote, if young people of color continue to be overburdened with debt and are not provided with a fair chance to gain the skills they need to pursue their interests, companies and communities will lose out on their talent, passions, and contributions. Supporting young people and their aspirations can build the inclusive economy that our nation needs, end quote. So, kind of a lengthy excerpt there from Harvard Business Review, but all great suggestions, great ideas on how we can start to build a more diverse and inclusive profession. And my guest this week, Anoop Mehta, has some insights into all of this as well, drawing upon his own experiences. This is a great conversation with just a great guy. Settle in for my conversation with Anoop Mehta. Well, Anoop, thanks for joining me. And you and I go back a little ways. We've known each other for a while, but I don't think I've ever heard your origin story. Give me a taste of the Anoop Mehta origin story. So, let's start. Where are you from originally?
Thanks, Bill. And it's always great to see you. And you're right. We do go back ways. And I appreciate the opportunity to be able to speak with you today. But my roots go back to, of course, India. I was born there. And I came to this country at the age of 12. Okay. Now, going back a little bit, I didn't stay in India before I came here. There was a period of time, actually 2 years, that I was in Africa, Tanzania, to be precise. That was in the mid-60s. I was there, and then I went back to India, and then I came here at the age of 12. So
Following your parents? Were they there?
Yeah, it was following my parents. So just to give you a little bit of that. So my dad was a chartered accountant. He practiced accountancy, and he was actually a lawyer too in India. And he was given an opportunity to go to Tanzania, Africa, to manage three offices of the CPA firm, gotcha. Or chartered accountant firm, I guess. So he took up that opportunity to do that. This was back in 1965, I think it was. Okay. And then, he got settled, and then he called us about a year later once he got everything settled and things like that. So I went to Africa in 1966. But I was there only 2 years. I left in 68. And at that time, that region was experiencing a lot of political unrest, and there were some issues there. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the, so I was going to a grammar school, basically. Still everything was English, but it was, the tide was changing, and it was becoming more into Swahili, their native language there. So my dad, parents decided that it was time for me to go back to India and perhaps continue my education there. So I went back to India in 68. And then at that time, I was raised with my uncles, grandparents, my cousins. So we had a large family. And some of my, the values really come from being in a large family.
Oh, sure.
We had about 15, 16 people in the house. So it was great. childhood, it was tough because we didn't have much, but it was tough, but it was a lot of fun. I became very close to my uncles and aunts, my family there, and my cousins. A couple of years later, my sister was born actually in India. I mean, in Africa, excuse me. So I have a brother who's 3 years younger than me, and a sister who's 10 years younger than me. Okay. So she was born in 70 in Africa. And then in 71, my brother was going to start the school system. So it was at that time my parents decided this was... we can't keep sending kids back to India to study.
Right.
So this is the time that they decided this is time to now leave. And my dad really didn't want to go back to India. And he had the options to either come here, U.S., Canada, or Australia. And it was funny, he was, he belonged to this club, and he was talking to a gentleman there, my dad was telling him a story about, well, my kids, education now, I need to make a decision. I wanted to leave this country. And Africa was an amazing life. I mean, he had a very, very good life, very comfortable. He was very highly respected, not only by the community, but within the government, like the IRS we have here, revenue department there. He was very well respected by everybody. And he left all of that for basically our benefit, because he wanted to make sure we got good education. So he was talking to this gentleman, and he, my dad was telling him a story, and the gentleman was actually, he said, it's great, but I will tell you, the best opportunities you will have is in the United States. And he said to Canada, Australia, you know, and this is back in the 70s, right? Early 70s, and there's still some, you know, discrimination. It's not as open, and I don't think you will have the opportunity. He listened, and he said, and the guy said, if you're really interested, you know, please come by office and I'll give you the visas. And he happened to be the American consulate. So it was that easy. And my dad and all of us got the visas at that point. And so my dad left Africa in 71. They all uprooted everything and went to India. My dad stayed for 3 months there and then came to the United States.
Was he leaving his job at that point?
Yeah, he was
coming to America without right. new work, just kind of uprooting and starting anew, right?
Yeah, exactly. Wow. Exactly. Now, my dad's younger brother was in Ohio. He was a professor at Ohio State. So when he first came here, he stayed there for a couple of months, and then he moved to the Washington, D.C. area, and then did some odd jobs here and there until he found his job with the CPA firm here in Silver Spring. Once he got settled there, then he called us. So he came in 71, we all came in 72. And since then, we've been in this wonderful state of Maryland.
We've been right here. All right. Yeah,
that's it.
I was going to ask why accounting for you, but it sounds like, I mean, it was just part, it was in your blood, basically. I mean, was that the attraction? You just saw your dad doing it?
I will tell you though, yes, you know, dad had a tremendous influence, but I think one of the other main influencers were my high school teacher, Mr. Miller. I mean, I still remember his name, and
Mr. Miller, you said?
Yeah, Mr. Miller. Okay. And I took an accounting class in 11th grade. And, you know, usually that's reserved for seniors. But I took it at 11th grade and I loved it. I just loved it. And he could see that. He could see my passion for it. And so he goes... And I told him that, you know, I still want to continue to pursue this, but that was the only course that was ever offered. And usually people take it in the senior year. He said, Anoop, don't worry about it. Just sign up for that class again. And we'll just do, you know, independent study. I'll give you problems and, you know, we'll use some other textbooks and workbooks and things like that. And that's exactly what I did. And so I go to the class, but... you know, I wouldn't be paying attention to what's going on. I'd be doing my own things because that's, you know, I was doing independent. I think there were like a handful of folks, a few of us that were in that kind of mode.
Right.
So that's what I did. So when I entered the University of Maryland, I knew exactly what I was going to do. And I pursued it. And it's been a great, great career for me, and it's a blessing that I went into accounting and I got my CPA.
What is it about the science itself, Anoop, that kind of attracted you to it? I mean, aside from having, you know, a dad who you looked up to and a professor who kind of pushed you in that direction, what was it about accounting that kind of attracted you to it?
I think a lot had to do with the way, you know, like my dad was respected, and when he talked and he was, you know, advising companies, businesses, and individuals about, you know, business, how to be successful, all those things kind of appealed to me. And I said, we start now using the word, you know, trusted advisor, but I didn't know that was what it was all about. And, and that's what attracted me. I said, you know, helping companies grow, helping businesses grow, helping individuals, you know, plan for their retirement, for future, all those things kind of attracted me. And I think that was the big part of why I wanted to do that.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
That's great. That's great. So, steering conversation a little bit toward more the diversity and inclusion angle here. And I guess, here in the U.S., of course, the stereotype is that accounting is, we've heard it forever. It's an old white man's profession, right? And to a large extent, I think the numbers kind of bear that out. According to the AICPA, a study that came out, their most recent study on this was in 2016, I believe. They said 70% of all new accounting graduates that were hired by CPA firms in 2016 were white, while only 16% were considered Asian, which I believe, according to U.S. Census data, that includes people from India. So we can assume that the percentage of CPAs in America who are of Indian descent is considerably less than 16%. I guess my question with all this, Anoop, is do you feel or have you felt that disparity? What's been your experience in this profession? As you look at the makeup of the profession, what kind of feelings bubble to the surface for you?
Yeah. I do wish we had a larger representation in the profession. It goes back, I guess, to when I first came here in 1972. I have a little bit different perspective. Now, first few years were very difficult. I was a kid, 12 years old. Mm-hmm. And my English, even though I was always going to grammar school, dialect is a little different. The style of speaking is a little different. I got picked on a lot, Bill. I did.
Was it just because of where you were from or because you were different in that way?
I think all. Yeah. I didn't speak properly. I looked different, obviously. Mm-hmm. And back in the 70s, early 70s, the Indian population wasn't a lot here. Mm-hmm. It was different. So, all in all, it just fitting in was very difficult for me, and I had a rough time. In fact, I'll tell you, in 1976, it was the first time we went back to India. Mm-hmm. after coming here, and I really pleaded with my parents that I didn't want to come back. I wanted to go stay in India, and of course.
Well, and you were, at this point, you were what, 16?
16, I was 16. Yeah.
So that's teenagers, it's that type of time, right? Yeah.
Right. And part of it, like I said, I told you that, I didn't make a whole lot of friends and it was for whatever reason. You could call it because of my, ethnicity, because of my color of my skin, whatever. But like I said, it was hard for me to fit in. Mm-hmm. And I think it started to change a little bit in college. And I started to get myself involved in a lot of organizations. I was, on the International Student Council over there. So this is something that my dad did so much of over his whole life, about community service and community work and belonging to these organizations. So I started to get a little bit of the taste, and I really think that helped for me to assimilate a little bit more. Now, even though these were organizations that were like the International Student Council, it's basically a lot of international students and representing them in the university environment. But still, I think it got me out there and made me more comfortable being around different people. And that helped a lot. So, but ever since then, I really don't feel that anybody's looked down on me because of my skin color or whatever. Mm-hmm. I think it's the opportunities were presented. I took those, and that's the thing. So early on, yes, I struggled a lot, but I would say, from the college days forward, it was, I don't think I've had, the experiences that I know a lot of my colleagues and people that I know have struggled, and they're still struggling. Mm-hmm. So I guess you know, I've been a little bit fortunate with that. But, you know, again, I'm in an environment, as you know, I'm in the aerospace industry, you know, I work with a lot of rocket scientists. And that's also a predominantly, you know, Caucasian, white, male industry. You know, I think they have been very accepting of me, and you know, because most of the colleagues that my counterparts in other organizations or the companies are PhDs or they have technical background, not a CPA, right? Mm-hmm. But here I am, you know, president of a company, and in fact, we have an organization that our company belongs to. It's a aerospace. It's called Maryland Space Business Roundtable. Basically, it's a umbrella organization that represents a lot of businesses, small, medium size, large in the community. And I've been on their board for many years. And actually, I was president for 2 years of that. So, I mean, it's there. It's been accepting. But I do know that there are so many folks that have not had the same opportunities and the same experiences that I've experienced.
Yeah, and I mean, I've spoken with a few of them, a couple of them that you know very well, Avanette Blanding, Kimberly Ellison Taylor, and almost every them and every other person of color that I speak to in the profession, it somehow when we get on this topic of diversity and inclusion, it always comes back. The conversation always comes back to swinging back to this, the importance of seeing other people in the profession who look like us, right? How do we make this a more diverse and inclusive profession? Well, it's by bringing young people into a profession and they see folks who look like them, who have shared their types of experiences. And I guess, I don't know, how do we start to bring that vision to life? You know, how can we start to bridge that gap?
Yeah. By the way, you know, I'm a huge fan of Kimberly and Evanette. I mean, you know, I admire them greatly. And I think what they're doing for the profession is just remarkable. And I continue to wish them and you know, in pursue this, making sure that our profession is well represented. I think the hard part is exactly the pipeline. I mean, it is, when you talked about the number, only 16% that are graduating are in the minority, right? Mm-hmm. How do we increase that? I mean, that's where we need to tackle. That's the area we need to tackle, which is, you know, I gave you my example. I was influenced tremendously by a high school teacher. Mm-hmm. So how do we get ourselves in front of that? So people like me, people like Evanette, people like Kimberly, we need to be out there. And I know they are, and I do what I can.
Oh, yeah.
But we do need to do more of it.
It seems like that influence for everyone that I've spoken with about this, it starts at a very young age, right? I mean, Kimberly talks about being heavily influenced by a CPA who came to speak to her elementary school, to her class when she was in elementary school, and you were influenced by a teacher at an early. It starts very, you know, it almost has to go well past the point of, you know, when they've had their first introduction to the profession. It has to start when they're at a much younger age, almost, it seems like.
Yeah. And I think, again, I think we need to rebrand the story. And because there's so much, I guess, misconception about what a CPA does. What is an accounting profession? What do accountants do? And, you know, immediately, if you just ask somebody in general public, guess what you're going to hear? Well, tax, account, you know, audit, that those are for, and that can't be the message, because that isn't the message.
Right.
You know, you know, Kimberly, myself, even Evanette, we all work in private industries. We don't work in public practice. We don't touch taxes and we understand them, but, and so that's the thing. So the way we have to approach it is that getting into this in front of the students at an early age, telling them just because you will become a CPA or going into the accounting profession doesn't mean you won't get to do what you enjoy doing. I mean, for instance, if you love sports, sports need accountants, CPAs. If you're in an entertainment business, that business needs accountants, CPAs. Mm-hmm. You know, even aerospace, right? I mean, even though, you know, I didn't pursue a technical skill of, you know, I work with a lot of PhDs, right? Very, very smart people, rocket scientists. Mm-hmm. Well, just because I'm not one of them doesn't mean I can't be in that industry. And that's what it is. I love the space industry. I've developed a great deal of fondness for, you know, protecting our environment, because that's what we do. Most of the work is in our earth sciences. And even though I don't get to do that, but I will get to work with people that do that and have a better appreciation for what climate change is all about, how important it is to protect our blue marble, you know, the blue pant planet. Mm-hmm. So I am in that industry which I enjoy, but I have a CPA background. So the way I like to sell this now is, in fact, I was talking to a couple of students about a year ago, is that this is a foundation. CPA is your foundation. You know, getting your degree, getting your CPA, that's your foundation. That is an entry to whatever you want to do. Mm-hmm. If you enjoy tax, and you know, I have to credit the AICPA for thinking ahead now. I mean, you know, you have this evolution project that's going on. Mm-hmm. That's infusing a little bit of technology, because there is a lot of fascination right now with technology, and the younger generation is interested in that. And I'm glad that we're changing some of the, so that to attract some of the technology-based, that interest into the profession, because let's face it, that's what we're, you know, we are doing. And I know, you know, the statistics too, that a lot of the major firms, they're higher of, accounting students has gone down. They're hiring a lot of the folks that have technology in their background. And so I applaud the AICPA for going through this evolution and seeing what we can take. But I think that's the thing. It's the story. We need to do more of that and tell the story that just because you're going into accounting doesn't mean you're going to do this or this. You can do whatever you want to do.
And you bring up such a great point, Anoop. I spoke on this podcast, this was almost a year ago, I think, with a professor of accounting from Cambridge. His name is Alan Jangelinzer. And he made that very point. He said he had accounting students coming up to him almost in tears and suffering from like physical ailments because they felt this pressure. They felt, because I'm studying accounting, I have to get hired by one of the big four. I've got to go into public accounting. I've got to do this. My parents are driving me to do this. And they felt this incredible pressure to do stuff that they weren't really passionate about. And Alan tells the story of sitting down with one of his young students and saying, listen, what are you passionate about? What do you love to do? Forget your studies, forget everything else, but what do you really love to do? And this person said, you know, I love the outdoors. I love hiking and kayaking and just being outdoors. And he said, well, you know, there's this company called REI.
Right, yeah.
And they have an accounting department. And you know, it's like almost anything that you're passionate about doing, there's a finance or accounting function tied to it. And so why don't you go do that? You know, and not that working for the big four is not noble. It certainly is. And certainly there are people who are passionate about public accounting, but not everybody has to go there. And I just thought that was such a great point. And what if we could tell that story more often and bring that passion to the surface for more young people? I just thought that was a really, really relevant point that he told.
And you know, Bill, look, close to 50% of the CPAs are working in private industries, right? Yeah. In business and industry, right? So, you know, there's a lot of great stories to be told, and we need to do more of that and inspire, you know, we can't wait till they get to the college level. We need to go to the high school levels to tell them this story, because then after that, it's, you know, they've already kind of started to develop their own thoughts and processes and things like that. I think at that age, which is, you know, 14, 15, 16 years old, mm-hmm. at that age is where we start to, you know, tell the story about what do we really do? Okay. Right. And there's right. so many things, and we really, and, you know, I think you earlier you asked about people seeing others, seeing you first and then seeing your, you know, people someone that looks like you.
Special, right.
Right. Yeah. Right. You know, that's so important, because you know what, that initial connection you have mm-hmm. when you see people like you, that builds that little trust level, that immediate trust level, right? For that, even a millisecond, right?
Yep.
Then you start to listen. And when you don't see those people that you can associate with or they look like you, then your message is lost because they're not even paying attention.
Right? Harder to make that connection, yeah.
Exactly. So this is where, you know, we talk a lot about trust. It is building that trust at that level, saying that, look, you know, you can do this, you can go into this profession and still manage to do whatever you want to do, you enjoy doing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've been working for 40 years now. And I'm telling you, Bill, I'm, you know, aside from all this noise that's going on with the pandemic and all the other things that are happening, unfortunately, you know, I'm still, you know, I enjoy my work. I really enjoy my work. I enjoy the people that I work with. And like I said, I wasn't smart enough to become a PhD in astrophysics or meteorology or whatnot. But I tell you, I still get to work with them it's thrilling. It really is thrilling.
You're a lucky man. That's great. You mentioned a few moments ago, Anoop, your thoughts about what the profession is doing, the evolution project and the progress that they've made. How is the profession doing in your view when it comes to this type of topic, diversity, inclusion, helping build a more diverse, equal and inclusive profession? What are your thoughts on that?
I think the profession is starting to address the issue, but I think we still have a long ways to go. You know, AICPA, MACPA, both are doing tremendous things. And they're making a concerted effort to address the diversity inclusion. Certainly, I think the major firms are beginning to embrace the diversity inclusion. But I think what has to happen is the mindset has to change. You know, at the senior leadership positions of a lot of these organizations, a lot of these firms, they're fine firms. They do a great deal of work. But how do you get that concept down to, you know, the hiring managers and the people that are below them in the sense that, you know, they report into? How do you get them to embrace that same? And it's not a, you know, we get it. And we need to not only get it from a standpoint, it's the right thing to do. And it's, you know, but it's also makes great business sense. Right. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where, I don't think we're doing as good a job as we could. We need to push these initiatives. And like I said, I mean, a lot of these organizations are pushing this, you know, diversity, equality, inclusion initiatives, and they're great. We need that. But how do we change the mindset day to day at the working level? That's where I think it's still a challenge. And I think it's still, we're ways off. Yep. And until we can do that, we're going to continue to have these challenges, and we're going to probably continue to have these discussions. And, you know, it's funny, you know, initiatives, I look at initiatives as they're short term. I mean, this is an initiative, we get it done. This is not something that can be done in a short period. This is a it is a, you have to continually look at this, and there is no finite period, you know, two months or 3 months or 3 years or 5 years. No, it's not. It has to be there day to day, every day, how we work. It has to be in our mindset that this is how we're going to approach it. When you hire, from a hiring, from the way you put your ads in. And, you know, I was just talking to somebody the other day. I attended a conference about, you know, infusing and sustaining women in STEM programs, because, you know, we have the same issue that we don't have as many women and minorities in this area, in the space, aerospace industry. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that we're talking about is, when we do a job description, when a hiring manager does a job description for an opening, okay, they need to take a hard look at it. Do they really need all those qualifications? Because the tendencies tend to be, and certainly I've seen this with the women and minorities. Well, I don't have this, I don't have this, and so maybe I don't qualify and I'm not even going to apply. Well, that's not, then we're not going to get that pipeline. We're not going to get those, you know, diverse applicants to be able to select from, right? So what we've instituted, and which is something that I learned, is that maybe go down to what is really critical, what skill sets are really critical, and maybe just put those down, and then the others are ancillary, right? And then you may have a lot more applicants applying because, oh, yeah, I've done this.
You can teach a whole lot of stuff that you're looking for.
Oh, yeah.
But you can't teach a person to be a good, you know, a good fit culturally. You can't. I mean, those are the kind of things that you're talking about here.
Exactly. And like the work ethics and all of those things, you know, those things don't show up in an application.
Right.
But that's what you should be looking at, because all, everything else. And, you know, we and I think you were there when I think a couple of years ago, you know, Dan Burris talked about this, right? He said, you know, 60-70% of what you're learning today will be obsolete in 3 to 5 years anyway, right? Exactly.
Yeah, no, that's a good point.
So why are we focusing on things that they're going to be changing?
Yeah.
Let's focus on some core capabilities that the individual should have. And I will tell you, that will open up, you know, so many opportunities for so many people. And I think that's the kind of thinking or the mindset that we need to instill.
That's great. What does the future of this profession look like to you, Anoop, when you think of it like 5, 10, 20 years down the road?
Well, you know, I think the future of the profession is, I think it's bright. But we need to continue to expand and address the diversity issue. You know, we are looked upon as the trusted advisors, right? And there's so much credibility we add by that. So we need to encourage, you know, if you're in business and industry or your clients are in business and industry, encourage them, show them this is not just about doing the right thing. It's about has real business value to it. So, you know, if you're talking to your clients, encouraging them that, you know, they need to embrace this, they need to do this. So there is so many things that we still need to be doing. But I believe in our profession. I believe it has a bright future, but we need to start changing some of these things. And like I said, we are in the right path. I think we are heading in the right path. We just need to do more and more of it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you know, and it starts with people like me also. It starts with people like me, you know, people like Kimberly, Evanette. We need to be out there more. We need to get out to, in front of the students and talk to them about as passionately I'm talking about you, with you about my career and all that. Mm-hmm. That's what people want to hear, and that's what students want to hear. And I think that's what's going to make an impact.
And I don't know, I guess we can end on this, but of course, this profession is part of this nation, and our nation is certainly experiencing its share of struggles in this area as well. Optimistically speaking, I guess, what does the future of this nation look like to you?
Oh, that's a tougher question.
that's a harder one, yeah.
I mean, if it continues down the path that it has the last few years, I'm not very optimistic. You know, there has to be a fundamental shift in everything, in our political process. We need to have civility back. Years ago, I remember back in, you know, when I first came to this country and we used to have political debates but there was a little bit of civility there. I mean, you may not have agreed on everything, but at least you listen, right?
Yeah.
That middle ground
seems gone for whatever reason. I don't know when it happened or how, but there seems to be very little movement lately for compromise you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And you can't do that when you're talking over people, right? I mean, you got to let people speak and you got to, there's a quote, I think you know, a lot of us hear to respond rather than hear to understand. Right. And I think that's what we need to practice more of, hear to understand. I think, you know, if I go back, what made this country great, which, you know, motivated my dad and my parents to come, which inspired so many immigrants to come here, is, you know, we had a huge middle class. I mean, unfortunately is going down, and you're seeing a huge gap with between the wealthy and people that are just getting by on a day-to-day basis. Right. We need to increase, wages so that people can make a decent living, you know. I mean, that's the thing, and it just bothers me when you know, companies, CEOs of these companies, when you see, you know, $30, $40, $50 million salaries, that's where I think we really need to make take a hard look at things. Of course, you know, health system. My God, I mean, you know, we're such a rich nation, but you see the impact. I mean, we've not done a good job with, handling COVID. There's no reason to have 200,000 or 200,000 people die. And so those are the things. But I'll tell you, Bill, you know, despite all these challenges and perhaps a little bit of my bleak outlook right now, I do believe in this country. I mean, I'm grateful to my parents for bringing us here. I'm grateful to be raised here. You know, I still believe.
Yeah, yeah.
This is where I want to make my life. You know, this is where I made my life, and I love this country, and this is what it's all about. So while it's a little bit bleak right now, but I have great confidence in the future and how things will get better.
Let's certainly hope so. And I think it's, you know, it's conversations like this that will start opening some of those doors. So Anoop, thank you so much for your time, for your insights, and for catching up. It's just been great to see you again.
Hopefully
someday we'll be able to do this in person. But
I hope so soon.
I know, me too. For the time being, Zoom is great. It's been great to spend some time with my friend. Thank you.
Yeah, same here. You take care. Have a great evening.
Oh, so great to reconnect with that guy. That was Anoop Mehta, president of Science Systems and Applications in Lanham, Maryland, just outside of D.C., and a former chair of the Maryland Association of CPAs Board of Directors. You can learn more about Anoop and his team at ssaihq.com. Don't forget also, this week's sponsor is the Business Learning Institute. Kind of combining business and learning there, the Business Learning Institute, the BLI's Future Ready Learning Framework outlines the skills that CPAs need to thrive in the rapidly changing world of accounting and finance. That framework is all about gaining and maintaining deep technical knowledge along with a strategic skill set. We're talking about strategic aptitudes that have been identified as most crucial for tomorrow's CPAs. Start mastering these future ready skills now by visiting macpa.org/future-learning-framework. And that's all I got, gang. Have a great week. Talk to you soon.